This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca. Ithaca, New York boasts an authentic craft beverage experience, tasty farm-to-table culinary adventures, and scenic outdoor recreation among 150 waterfalls. Plan your trip today with help from visitithaca.com.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of the Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I've been a part of the HRN community for over 9 years and nearly 400 episodes. And even after all that time, I'm constantly inspired by the incredible voices on our network. Each week, I record my show in the HRN studio made of two recycled shipping containers because I'm excited to bring you, our listeners, the most important stories from the food world. All of us here at HRN make food radio because we love it. This year, HRN is celebrating its 10th anniversary, but we need your support to keep food radio going strong for the next decade. Join the HRN community today by becoming a member. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate right now. And you can even show some love for my show by selecting the food scene in the designation drop-down menu. Thanks for listening to HRN. Welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Matt Abergel. And what's really cool about having you here right now is that you aren't from here. You kind of are. You're from Hong Kong via Canada. And you are probably best known for two specific words, and that's chicken and charcoal. And we're going to talk about your Canadian upbringing and try to figure out what the classic chicken or charcoal dishes are there and why you become a yakitori master overseas. But first, let's talk about this Canadian aspect of you and your life. Where in Canada were you born?
Calgary, Alberta.
And does Alberta have a barbecue, you know, history? Is that ingrained in that culture?
Yeah, I mean, you basically, when it's nice enough outside, so like 4 months of the year, but you know, You everyone's outside and you barbecue every weekend, and I mean, you cook outside as much as you can when you can.
Talk to me about the contraptions that you've barbecued on during your lifetime. Like, what was your first barbecue?
I mean, that was the first charcoal barbecue. That was in my dad's backyard, and I used like lump charcoal. I mean, you just collect pine needles from around, like dry pine needles, to start the charcoal. That was always like the fun. I loved trying to like get it lit. And you get it all spread out, and you always end up burning like the first round of chicken wings.
Yeah, it's like the pancake, right?
Exactly.
You throw out the first one.
Fuck.
But then you use those for something else, I'm sure, either the dogs or a stock, etc. Yeah. But I was also reading that you had a large family, and that six aunts. You never knew which one was coming over for lunch, but on this big old oil barrel, you'd grill kebabs, and each one had their own recipe. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me what those recipes were and what a gathering around that grill was like?
So when I say kebab, I mean like it's like a burger kind of, and a lot of them, most of the time is lamb, and then mixed a ton of parsley, garlic, onion, sumac, depending on who it was, cumin. One of my aunts puts pomegranate seeds in there. And they were mostly responsible, though, also for all the side dishes, right? So a lot of tahini, a lot of vegetables. One of my aunts has a farm, that lives on a moshav, so she brings like she makes the best vegetables. She's amazing. And then on the grill, we'd do like chicken hearts interspersed with lamb fat, like so they basically like in between the chicken heart would be lamb fat. That's my favorite.
I love, even throughout the book, you weave fat in. So you're creating like your own subcutaneous layer per whatever you're grilling. And
yeah,
I mean, that makes the tastiest food when that stuff renders and, you know, gets chewy.
Especially with
crispy.
The birds we use, like they have such nice sub, like they're underneath the skin and also intramuscular. Amazing for a chicken. Amazing.
So the kebabs, Israeli, where do you identify as a Canadian, as an Israeli, as someone who worked in New York, as now a Hong Kong expat?
Yeah, I mean, Hong Kong is 100% my home. That's for sure. I probably identify as Canadian, but have no interest in going back to Canada. I feel very proud of Hong Kong as a city. and it, I treat it like it's my city, you know? So.
Well, they certainly have embraced you, it seems. Yeah. Back to Canada. Are there any classic chicken dishes or grill dishes that you think have carried throughout your career or that we might see a slight influence in Yardbird in Hong Kong?
Not from Canada, no. No. Not, I mean, from family, but not from specific. Canada is a pretty, like, uninteresting culinary heritage, I think, as a country. But for us, I mean, I grew up, all my friends were first generation Canadians. My dad's not born in Canada. Every one of my friends, pretty much his parents, were not born in Canada. And Calgary especially is a very young city. So for me, I don't know that there is such a thing as Canadian food so much. It's, you know, it's like for me, when I go to Canada, the first thing I eat is Vietnamese food. The second thing I eat is Chinese food. You know, like it's even living in Hong Kong, I still crave Canadian Chinese food, you know?
Oh, that's fine. Well, I was always, not to assume that you're a hockey fan, but I was assuming that the Calgary Flames, the Flame had something to do maybe with the grilling culture there.
I don't know where it came from, but probably has more to do with like the Oilers and the Flames.
Oh, gotcha.
Like I don't know shit about hockey, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, you certainly know your way around a bird, and it seems like that's been generational, too. There's an instance in the book where you talk about roasted Cornish hens by your bubby, your grandmother in Yiddish, or you know, birds being braised by your sata, your grandmother in Hebrew. Yeah. Can you talk to me about growing up with those kind of family members, cooks, and dishes in your life?
Yeah, I mean, the Cornish hens were something that were very... It was every Friday. That we would go, you know, eat as a kid. We'd always have Shabbat dinner, and we'd always have Cornish hens every day, every single time. And I would eat, like, they're, you know what a Cornish hen looks like? It's small. And she roasted them in this weird, like, convection oven that she had that sat on her dryer. It's like, you know, she only brought it out to do that, and it really, they were good. Like, she'd leave them outside first for like a good like 2-3 hours and just rub them with paprika and like just like a little bit of oil, and you could eat like the wingtips. You could crunch through the bones. Like, I would, there'd be very little left of that bird when I was done with it. And I was like my mom would get so pissed. She'd be like, stop chewing on the bones. You're going to choke. I'm like, I always eat the bones. Like, I'm.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you give me a chicken wing, like, you won't, like, there's almost like, I'll chew the bones.
Have you ever choked on a bone?
I've never choked on a bone. Okay, I recently cracked my tooth on one, though.
Worth it, though.
It was interesting. I was in Vietnam, and it was like this like whole rotisserie bird. It was so fucking good, and I just, yeah, cracked my tooth.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in those trances where you're eating something and you don't realize what you're doing. I don't know if this ever happened to you, but you bite the fuck out of your finger.
I've never bit my finger.
Okay, so that's just me. But you know, you get so into it, and you work in your way around those bones, and yeah. So I guess that's just a me thing.
Yeah.
But let's talk more about these chickens. You have had a whole bunch of favorite chicken dishes throughout your life that aren't necessarily ones that were, you know, made with charcoal. Tell me about your favorite fried chicken, your favorite rotisserie, your favorite nuggets.
Fried chicken was. One of my best friends growing up, his dad had a very, very seedy hotel called the St. Louis. And they did kettle fried chicken. Big ass kettle. Like the size of this fucking table.
Yeah.
And it
like
was
like real KFC.
Yeah. And it was amazing. That shit was, and it was good cold, and it was good hot. And it was a fucking weird ass place. And they only served it kind of in the basement, which is a bar, very like divey bar. We were kids. We used to go, like, you know, on the weekends, go visit his dad, and like, just, yeah. So that was definitely my favorite fried chicken. You said rotisserie?
Yeah, rotisserie.
I love rotisserie chicken. So even bad rotisserie chicken is still good.
Yeah. I mean, it's having a little boom in the States right now. A lot of people are doing that Francophile, you know, Parisian chicken and drippings and potato thing going on.
See, I don't particularly like French style rotisserie. I think they overdo everything. They overdo the marinade. I like Peruvian. I like the more like the kind of the spatchcocked.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's way better.
Hawaiian style is pretty good, too.
Is spatchcocking better because of the surface area, that you can get more flavor on the exterior? Why?
The spatchcocking makes sense to me. I mean, that's kind of first of all, you're exposing all of the skin kind of to one side, more or less. So already there you're winning, because you can control that. And everything's exposed. Like, there's not that little flabby part under the arm when they have, there's a lot of things that, and you can just control it better. Definitely.
Can you control nuggets?
Absolutely. How many you can put in your mouth?
But, I mean, it's been chicken in all shapes, sizes, and forms throughout your life that you've been akin to. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that your protein of choice?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I like one-word answers. Like, you didn't even have to think about it. But then charcoal, is that your energy source of choice?
Absolutely, for yakitori. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And for what I do, I mean, I think that's what gives us... It's a distinctive flavor. It connects us. You know, I think the flavor of chicken and charcoal relaxes people. I think that it automatically makes you more friendly. You're more open to whatever you're about to experience, like, it gives you a familiarity. So definitely, yeah.
Yeah, so you're like, is it the opposite of King of the Hill? It was that cartoon, and the main character, Hank Hill, was, a propane salesman, and he hated charcoal. He like, really? So I think you're his antithesis.
I mean, I like cooking on all types of energy sources, but definitely for, like, barbecue. I mean, like, if you wanted, and chicken, and, I mean... But fish tastes better on charcoal, and beef tastes better on charcoal. Everything tastes better with charcoal, in my opinion.
When did you have this realization? Because I know in high school you started working in kitchens.
Yeah.
Was that more for the money, or did you figure out your methodologies then?
Like, regarding the charcoal?
Or just cooking. In general?
No, I loved cooking from about 12, I'd say. I just like to, make things... whatever I would eat, and then I would try and figure out what was in it and try and recreate it. I spent a lot of time, I always loved going to markets, like Chinese grocery stores or Vietnamese grocery stores when I was a kid. And I would just buy weird shit and take it home and cook it. And my mom would be like, what the fuck is that? Like, I don't know. I was a vegetarian for a long time too. So when I was always really into Asian greens, all the bok choys and choy sums and gai lan, and so many different varieties. So that's what I was.
I know the vegetarian veganism is a little bit in line with the punk movement, but you were a skateboarder.
Yeah.
Was the vegetarianism part of that culture?
No. The vegetarianism for me was out of interest. I wanted to know what, like, I don't know, just when to be able to focus on it. I think because in Calgary, eating was just a very monotonous kind of thing in a way. A lot of meat, I'm mildly allergic to potatoes. So it's like, I wasn't ever that excited about that kind of style of food. So we, and our family ate a lot of Asian food. So it was more like just trying to explore vegetables and explore what you can eat. Like, if you go out of your way just to eat vegetables, kind of.
I mean,
I didn't care about animals.
Yeah,
if that was your asking.
Yeah, I mean, roundabout. But then, why the interest in traveling to Korea, Japan, Malaysia after high school?
Because I love the food. I was supposed to be gone for a long time. I was supposed to be gone for a year, but I broke my leg in Malaysia. So after Malaysia, I was supposed to go. I think I was supposed to go to Vietnam and Thailand, and I had planned and purchased trips. Like, I was good for a year. I had enough money for a year. Japan was the first place because a friend, and Korea was the second place because of a friend. Both of that trip definitely very much gave me the confidence to just explore both those cuisines a lot more. So I had a very just clear idea, because the people I ate with there, and at the time I had very little money, right? So I'm not going to nice restaurants. I was going to izakayas. I was going sidewalks and just trying to find, because and the food there is really it was less reasonable then, but like it was more expensive then. But now, like, it's so reasonable.
And we're talking Tokyo.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, agreed. Yeah,
I was in Chiba in Tokyo the first time.
Yeah, I agreed. And a lot of people go there assuming you have to do high-end Kaiseki, omakase. Let's talk about that first time experiencing yakitori in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. If you remember where you went.
It was at the gates of Inokashira Park in Yoyogi. And it was like this, it was an after work spot. So it was like half indoor, half outdoor. Like they were grilling, but like there was a kind of a window going out and just standing tables. And people just kind of like hung out and had a beer or had a highball and really cheap sticks. Like, and you just kind of like, you know, you just order and it was a long grill and he's pretty much just continuously cooking. So you order like what you want. He just literally just picks up and hands it to you. It's ready right away. Some, maybe a few plates that are just like sitting there. That was when I kind of like really fell in love with Japanese food, because then I realized that it was like, you know, when I eat growing up in Calgary, like fucking udon, like shitty udon, like really bad udon, really bad tempura, terrible, but sometimes good, terrible sushi, you know, like really like rolls and shit like that, like guilty pleasure rolls, but terrible rice, everything bad. Mm-hmm. But it was all, or like Benihana's, you know, which is called Edo, Japan, where I'm from. And Japanese Village. That was another one. So then we got there and I was like, man, there's so much more. And also just the fact that these places are tiny, that they're only doing one thing. That's what got me. I mean, like the singularity of it.
The one thing is a very defining thing too in this day and age where we try to put a name and associate even fast casual to a restaurant. Or do you consider yourself a chicken restaurant, a yakitori place? I mean, how would you describe what you do now?
We cook yakitori. I don't think I don't think you can describe a restaurant as yakitori. I mean, we cook yakitori. We do our best to make people feel welcome. We just want to have a nice, comfortable restaurant.
Yeah.
That we do things the way we want to do them.
So it's a little bit of that Japanese term omotenashi, you know, the hospitality aspect. But then the way you want to do things seems a little different, not as maybe servile as some of the places you'd approach in Japan.
Yeah, I mean, like, obviously I'm not Japanese, and I think that's one of my greatest, my greatest ability is advantages to cook Japanese food and not be Japanese. You know, I've studied it and I deeply respect it, but there's a lot of things that I don't agree with, and that I, you know, working in Japanese restaurants, there's a lot of things that those people don't agree with either, but they don't say anything because they can't, because they'll get smacked, or, you know, like, we run some things very Japanese and we run other things not at all. So
we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about the best parts of the chicken. Okay. And also the concept and evolution of Yardbird as a whole. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca. Located in New York's Finger Lakes region, Ithaca boasts an authentic craft beverage experience, tasty farm-to-table culinary adventures, and scenic outdoor recreation. As the saying goes, Ithaca is gorgeous. The city is home to 150 waterfalls and gorges sprinkled through its downtown and sloping hillsides. State parks and acres of natural lands offer outdoor recreation for every level of enthusiast. Come stroll among the cool ravines, scenic hiking trails, and natural vistas. Ithaca is home to Ivy League Cornell University and Ithaca College, resulting in an influx of new cultures, new tastes, and new energy every year. There's so much to explore, from art galleries and museums to unique attractions like the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Ithaca sits at the heart of a blossoming heritage and craft cider industry. Some of these delicious ciders can be bought in market, but many of the most unique varieties can only be experienced with a visit to Ithaca and this great cider region. Go to visitithaca.com to get inspired and plan your trip today.
Are you enjoying this show? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. I'm Luke Griffin, and I'm the host of Bushwick Podcast. Each week, we share the remarkable stories of how artists, activists, and entrepreneurs collide in Bushwick, a special Brooklyn neighborhood that's changing faster by the day. You can find Bushwick Podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here with Matt Abergel of Yardbird in Hong Kong. And I want to talk to you about the best parts of a chicken. Or first, let's define the word yakitori.
Okay.
What does it mean?
Yaki means grilled. Tori means bird.
It's that simple, right?
Yeah.
But is it really that simple?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it can be that simple. I think... Yes. And no.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you go to a yakitori place, there's a selection of different parts of the bird. Yeah. You can get a neck, you can get a tail, a soft bone. What are the easiest ones to cook and the hardest ones to, you know, present?
I think that once you kind of understand the charcoal and how your grill is, then... You know, you can cook anything, but the hardest ones are probably the ones that have the most fat to render. So like tail, different types of the skin. Those are the ones that you take a lot more technique, I guess, and time. Things like the heart, super easy, super fast. Yeah, so I think those are like a fairly committed period of cooking.
I was going to ask what came first, the chicken or the charcoal, but really you have to get the best damn chicken possible to be able to grill over that charcoal to make the greatest effect. You had the pleasure of working at Masa, one of the most lauded restaurants in New York, if not the States, if not the world. And I don't want to talk about Masa that much. I actually want to talk about Carlo.
Mm.
Talk to me about who Carlo is and why he is as much an institution of Masa as Masa is.
So Carlo is La Pera Brothers. I think they're out in Bed-Stuy. And he works... I mean, he for me, was the... It was the first introduction kind of into the idea of things being killed to order. An ingredient for me to be... Like, just asking to be, you know, slaughtered on the day and coming in. And, you know, he was just great. He really gave a great service. You know, he came in, he had a conversation with you, he talked to you about the chickens. He'd make sure you're happy, you know. And that was like I think for me, he was quite a pivotal person, like to meet someone like this who has a lot of pride in what he does and just a great product. I mean, like the product was just so much better than every other chicken. And he was just, it's like no one knew.
Yeah, it's been such an ingrained part of being a Japanese chef to have that shokunin. Yeah. You know, have that person that you go directly to for that singular thing, kind of like how people are coming to you for yakitori now. What was Masa's qualification of a good bird, a good chicken?
I think, like, his qualification was for everything. It was that it was... at its freshest state, and it was the best example of that product for him. Whatever that product needed to taste like, if it, you know, like it was it was the essentials of what that product's supposed to be. And for him, I think it was obviously fat, flavor, texture, ability to get crisp skin, you know, like not watery, not mushy, certainly not old.
Yeah.
You know, he does have a very, very, very sensitive nose. Like, that guy can smell anything from anywhere. And I mean, that's how we gauge freshness as humans. So yeah.
With Masa, you know, being the figure that he is in the States, a lot of people assume that it's just a sushi or omakase or maybe even closer to a kaiseki restaurant. What yakitori skills did you learn from working there that have carried over to Yardbird?
I mean, his approach, the things I learned, I didn't learn how to cut chicken from Masa. We learned we kind of taught ourselves in that sense, but he taught us how to cut fish. And so taking and taking that approach of how to cut fish to cutting chicken was what we learned. And so, you know, obviously just being very gentle, using the sharpest knives you can possibly use, and figuring out how to not waste anything, how to get every single piece of meat off that bone. You know, like for staff meal there, we would eat fish carcasses all the time, and they're delicious. You know what I mean? Like, it, you know, just that kind of, that was the, what he taught us. He taught us how to look at something and see way more than I think most people do.
Or you could put a fish collar on the menu and eventually people will buy it.
Right. We served collars all the time, made them for soup. And it was mostly for VIPs, you know, like the VIPs who come in, they get the fish head, like all the time.
Were you ever a VIP at either Yakitori Toto or Torishin?
I worked at Torishin.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we went to Toto a lot.
So talk to me about those two places in New York, because, you know, they still exist. Yeah. They still thrive. What kind of restaurants are they, and how profound of an effect have they made on you?
Well, Toto was our spot. Every Sunday, me and Lindsay would go eat at Toto, almost every Sunday. And, you know, it was that feeling that you actually craved these, like, you would crave those chicken wings. And all they are fucking chicken wings cooked on charcoal with salt. And it was like, and we'd love to drink there. And there was no pretension. We always thought the service could be better. And that was one of the things that we talked about all the time. We'd sit there, we'd look at each other and just talk about how, like, we love eating like this and I love cooking like this. But the service could be different. And, we, you know, that's where it got conceptualized. Torishin happened by chance, where they were just opening and I was kind of on the tail end of my time here. And they needed some help. A friend introduced me, and I ended up just being there for like 3 months, just helping them open. That's where I learned a lot of technique, like about butchering. We were already, and skewering as well. Yeah. So a lot of the technique comes from there.
Well, let's jump to Hong Kong. It's not a big jump, because you kind of decided while in New York, I've done all I can here. You had a daughter. It was time to move. Time to move on. Was it time to have your own thing, or was it time just to be someplace else?
Man, it was time to make some money.
I'm still trying to figure that out.
So I took a job as the head chef of Zuma, which that they had offered me a job in Dubai at some point a few years before. And I was just like, I'm not fucking going to Dubai. And then I basically, like, when I found out that Lindsay was pregnant and that we were like planning, we got a plan to leave. I couldn't stay in the States. I called him and I was like, yo, do you guys have any, the chef I knew, and he asked me, you guys hiring? He's looking for people. I thought I was just going to get like a sous chef position or something. And they ended up flying me out to London and just, they offered me the head chef position in Hong Kong. I'm like, I've never been to Hong Kong. He's like, okay, you can go. We're going to send you to Hong Kong for 3 days.
Like, you have plenty of time to figure it out.
You can come back and make a decision. And I'm like, okay. So when, like, just, I literally looked at like the price of diapers or something stupid and the price of rent, and the food is good. And so I was like, okay. Took the job. And then, I mean, that was a big restaurant. It was a 10,000 square feet restaurant. 37 chefs. I never managed that many people or that many seats ever. So it was a good learning experience. And then 2 years of that, I was done. And I loved Hong Kong. I really love it. So we just decided to stay.
It's not a downgrade, but it's definitely much smaller, Yardbird, at what, 1,400 square feet. And when you opened up that restaurant, were you looking to serve volume? Were you looking... What kind of...
I wanted my one restaurant. We thought it was just going to be chill. Yeah. And like I was just going to cook. And very romantic ideas of what it was going to be. Like, we started off with 10 chickens a day, 3 guys in the kitchen. That was it. And it was like, you know, it's like just cook and be really happy with like doing 50 covers a day. Like, that was the goal.
And now you're doing 50 birds a day.
We're doing 80 now.
Whew.
And there it was like... The kitchen was tiny, 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 tiny. And so the beginning of the first like week or so, we were doing like 10 chickens a day. And then the second week, it was like 20. Third week, it was 30. And it was like, and it just kept on getting busier and busier and busier. And then we maxed out. We couldn't physically fit or cook any more than 55 chickens, basically, in that spot. And then, yeah, I mean, the idea was just to, like, I wanted just to have a, that's why I opened Ronin. Like, Ronin is now where I can actually just go and cook.
Ronin is your, like, Japanese seafood slash whiskey bar, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so you like taking these single concepts and honing in on them. But I want to get back to Yardbird because, again, you can't have a chicken restaurant without having a chicken guy.
Yeah.
So who's your guy there?
Hopwo Poultry. So it's a father son, Ivan, and we call him Mr. Wong because he's Mr. Wong. And they provide us with a triple yellow chicken, and they're killed less than a block from the restaurant now. We moved.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's even closer to the. Probably why I moved.
Yeah, the felicity of that.
Yeah,
but they split them, they bleed them, they feather them, eviscerate them, they pack them into bags. Then what do you do?
First step is,
and I wasn't trying to downplay that. Like they did all
man,
that.
I'm not
like,
a fucking. Yeah. I don't want to do that. You want to do that for 80 chickens every morning? No, thank you. That's not a fun job.
And plus, they're giving you amazing chickens, organic, free range, hormone free, heirloom bred. But most of all,
they're not organic.
Okay,
yeah,
but fresh.
Fresh, all that shit. Like they won't say any of that are organic, hormone free. Mm-hmm. Like they have antibiotics because they have to. Like every year, there's bird flu in Hong Kong, which takes out thousands of birds and people's livelihoods. You know what I mean, like
So it's like opening a steak place in London, calling it Mad Cow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you don't want that.
They're fresh.
That's the most important thing. Yeah. I was lost there for a second. They're fresh. They're amazing. They're delicious.
I don't know if anyone's ever asked you this before, but what does a fresh chicken smell like?
It should smell like flesh, like you know, and it like depending. I mean, it just smells like chicken, in a good way. Yeah. Not in a bad way. You know what I mean? Like that's a hard thing to describe what it should smell like.
Because I've had torisashi, the raw chicken down in Kyushu.
Doesn't smell like anything.
No, but there's a distinct, you know, textural thing that's amazing about that. What are you going for? Smell, flavor, texture. What is it about these birds that have become yard birds?
All of the above. Texture is amazing. The fat is the best part, for sure. Just the depth of flavor you get off of them. And the ratios of size, like the way that the legs are, the breasts are small, the wings are wide, the neck is really thick compared to other chickens. They just lend themselves really well to what we do.
One of my favorite parts of this book, Chicken and Charcoal, is that you have these exploding diagrams of all the pieces of chicken. I think there's 29 from head, coxcomb. The wing has the tip skin, the wing skin. There's tail, breast, oyster, thigh, both regular thigh and inner. I mean, goes on and on and on. When did you realize that there were more parts of a chicken than just saying, do you want chicken?
When I was young. I mean, like I said, I loved eating the whole thing. And it was funny because my dad's house, his wife's father had like a frozen foods business. And he would take whole chickens and cut them crosswise on a bandsaw. And so you'd get these chicken steaks that had like, can you imagine, right? If you think about cutting a chicken down the middle when it's frozen, it had like all like the org, like it had like little bits of the innards inside, and you have like the rib, and you have all these amazing parts. So you aren't eating together, and you don't even know what you're really eating. So I mean, then also the hearts and everything like that. Liver was always constantly around me. So chicken feet, we used to order for dim sum. We used to go for, you know, we eat a lot of Chinese food. So it's always been there.
But then of a bird's anatomy, and I think it's through your website or your blog that you actually have these amazing posts, and you post about a specific part of the chicken. And one of the ones I read recently was of the Achilles. Mm. What is it about these specific pieces that set them apart? Let's go with like Hatsumoto.
Yeah.
What is it and what's delicious about it?
Well, I think the main thing that is, it will, is like I said, again, the singularity allows you to cook something very specifically. There's no, you know, there's no different, like, you don't have to worry about multiple elements in this dish. This is cooking one single piece of an animal as close to what we think is perfect as possible. Hatsumoto is the ventricle of the heart, and that's a textural one. Obviously, you get some of the fat, so you're cutting off some of the fat as well, and then we'll cut a few hearts up and slice them in between, just kind of bulk it up and give it another little textural thing. But those get, there's somewhere like, so the little, because they're kind of coming out, and so the tips get crispy, and the actual ventricles themselves still have a little bit of chew, and then you get little bursts of fat and meat kind of going all the way through. And then we dip that one in tare quite a bit, and we season it also, again, with salt. So it's heavily seasoned and has a Kyoto shichimi on it, which is like a roasted shichimi. It's a little spicier than our blend because you're chewing it for a while. Like, it's like...
Yeah.
You know, it's like there's a little...
Do that sound in the microphone again. That's a good sound.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't ASMR, but I mean, this is as good as it gets when it comes to chicken. Tebakawa is another one that I love because it has so much going on. It has the chew. It has the crispness. What is tebakawa?
Tebakawa is the wing tip skin. Or actually just means wing skin. But we don't use the Japanese word for anything now, so we're just using English words. But the wing skin is the piece in between the drumstick and the midwing, and then it's the wing tip skin is just the thicker side of the wing tip that where the feathers are held.
See, it's so fascinating because you might think that these are very simple things because you've been doing them for so long, or we can say something like, you know, thyroid.
Yeah.
I know that's a little abstract, but it's just a little piece. There's so much that has to actually be done to it, and so it has to be watched, and it has to be cared for to come out as deliciously as you're cooking them. But you also have to know how to skewer them. It seems that's a really fascinating lost art in my mind, because it's not just sticking a piece of wood through a piece of meat, is it?
No. See, the thing is, the preparation is much more important than the cooking in this situation. You still got to cook it properly, but that's easier than, it's much easier than cutting it and skewering it. It's absolutely the most important part.
Yeah. I mean, what about adding the umami? Because you spray your chickens with what? Sake, you season them with seaweed salt. Is that more important than the flavor of the binchotan?
You know, I think that no. I think that obviously, first and foremost, the chicken is the most important thing. Then the seasoning, probably, and then the charcoal it's really not an easy, they're not that accessible just to grab some binchotan and light it up. And you know what I mean? Like, it's a pain in the ass sometimes. It's like, it takes like 2 hours to fucking light. So I think that if people are going to enjoy it, I think they should enjoy it I think it's an amazing, amazing thing. But if you can get on a barbecue, okay, get on a barbecue, go outside, you know, have some fun.
I want to talk about your menu because it's not just all traditional Japanese yakitori, and you said that's, you know, a great attribute of yours not being Japanese. The green miso breast, the thigh with Tokyo onion, those are a little more traditional. Where does it get less traditional?
The green miso one is probably the least traditional one. That's the only one that's not, and that's kind of like a funny one. We just were stoned and just being stupid, and we're like, we kind of made like a pesto miso, which is essentially what this is. And it was just like a funny, because we have the Caesar salad, so it was like a grilled chicken Caesar salad. So that's definitely the most non-traditional, I'd say. All the other ones are pretty in line.
Then you have really cool stuff that isn't grill stuff, too. You have your KFC, but it's cauliflower. Korean fried cauliflower. A corn tempura. You have your own fried chicken, like your karage on menu. The one I was actually most interested about was the chicken and egg rice. Is that like an how do you say it? Oyakodon?
Oyakodon?
Yeah.
No, it, I mean, definitely similar elements. The chicken egg rice actually comes from an idea that it's a combination of two things. First of all, it's mochi rice and cooked in a technique that we learned from Masa. So he used to make his very well-known uni rice, and that was the same technique. So it's cooked like a risotto, essentially. I'm pretty sure he invented this. I don't think that it had ever really been done that way before. Par cook it. You soak it overnight. You par cook it. And you cook it like a risotto. And then as a combination of that, and then my grandmother used to make this like super ghetto fried rice. You remember those pancake cookers? Like, you know, like those things that are like a skillet, but it's like a pan you plug in, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So my grandmother would make like, she'd cook rice with a chicken powder, like a shit ton of chicken powder, and then frozen peas and eggs. And that was her thing. And so the flavors are more from that. We do caramelized onions in chicken fat. It's like schmaltz onions, basically. That's the primary. That's the primary flavor in that rice.
You know, we've talked about food a lot, but I think yakitori is also so visual. Hmm. Not just watching the chef prepare, but seeing it on the plate because of the garniture, because, you know, you eat with your eyes first. We can talk about that, but I'd actually rather talk about the design, the elements of Yardbird and even Ronin and your life that come along with furniture, with collaborating with artists. How important are the visual aspects of, you know, Yardbird and you as a person?
I mean, I definitely enjoy that. I hope to one day not be cooking anymore and just design restaurants and build things. And it's it's a real just focus and interest that I have. And I think that it's one of the most interesting things I could do because I get to make, we get to think of ways to do things and actually realize them and just be able to present something that can be complete and kind of silent at the same time. So it's nice. It's nice to be able to see it wear and tear and break and fix, and you come up with solutions, and to be involved in all those decisions is really important to me.
Talk to me about Sean Dix.
So Sean Dix is a very close friend of mine now. I met him. So basically I was looking for chairs for Yardbird, for the first Yardbird in Hong Kong. And I had put on hold this 33 Friso Kramer Revolt chairs, which are like a very classic school in, you know, I think it was designed in like the 51 or something like that.
Yeah, they're like very institutional.
Very institutional, but really well made, and they look good. They're a fucking beautiful chair. And I put a lot of those on hold to be shipped from Amsterdam, like trying to get them for the restaurant. And I just was Googling and more, and I was getting deeper into a rabbit hole of chairs. And I came upon one of Sean's chairs. And I was like, oh, and I didn't know. I liked the chair. I clicked on the chair. Turned out it was Sean. Turned out he was based in Hong Kong. I had no idea. And so I just found his office number, and I called the office. And one of his designers answered, and she's like, he'll call you back. Give me your number. Like 5 minutes later, he calls me back. And his office was less than 3 blocks from Yardbird, where it was originally. And so I just walked over there, and he had this beautiful, huge wall of design books. And we just talked. And we were already like 3 months into construction. Like, it was designed more or less. When he got in, he just redid a lot of it, made it better. And then we came up with a chair. We were just sketching chairs. You know, cause the Friso Kramer thing came up, and we talked about that a lot. And we got to just, it was amazing, you know, just come up with a, he's incredible. Come up with a chair, and he named it the Yardbird chair, and that's it. And we've been using that chair ever since.
That's what I love. I have a whole bunch of friends who have been to your restaurant and they're like, oh, it's so fucking delicious. It's so great. It's really comfortable. And by that, they often refer to the seating.
Yeah.
And how often do you hear that about a restaurant?
That's the thing about design, right? Like, I'm so into acoustics right now. Like, I'm just, like, that's the, for me, like, when I'm designing now, I want to just design based around acoustics. I actually want to start with acoustics and go backwards. Like just because it's, I think it's the most functional form of design that you can't even, like, I was just in a sound booth room. Like, I've never been in a room that quiet. It's insane. It's fucking weird. Anyway, so yeah.
And then working with Evan Heacox, yeah, who's an artist, is that functional design or is that something else?
Oh, that was like a full nerd moment for me. I mean, like, I grew up skateboarding, and he's been my favorite artist for years. I used to buy all his prints every time they released. I bought all his prints. And when I was working on the restaurant, I was like, you know, I'm just going to go out on a limb and see if I can get a hold of Evan Heacox through a friend and see if he'll do our logo. And he fucking did. Like, he was like, I never talked to him before that day. You know, and it was like, I called him and I emailed him and then talked to him on the phone. And it was like within 3 days or something, he'd done it.
What were the words that you used to describe what you wanted as far as the logo, what Yardbird was going to be?
I just wanted his hand. You know, his hand is that. And to me, it's very iconic for growing up because it was for Chocolate Skateboards, which is my favorite skateboard company. And that was their logo. It was his writing. So it's like, just, it's all this kind of, it's distinct for me. And it's distinct for my community of skateboarders. Like, people and art and people that like art. But I think the skateboarders especially recognize it right away. And that was important for me. I wanted us to have identity of, you know, a community that we already belong to.
I have one last question, which I'm hoping amalgamates a lot of things for you, for us. But if you were to design a new piece of chicken, you know, maybe the oyster part of the chicken wasn't a well-known thing 50 years ago. What cut of chicken would you want to be called the Yardbird? Like, is it fatty? Is it have a lot of skin?
Oh, it definitely has skin. Yeah, definitely fatty. I'd like something with some cartilage. Yeah.
Does this bones exist on the bird?
Yeah, the knee bone. The knee does definitely have all those things. It doesn't have as much skin. It has fat, though.
Yeah. I mean, have you ever used transglutaminate meat glue to make your Frankenstein ideal of the perfect piece of chicken? Would you ever?
I have no interest in gluing chicken.
So the best part of the chicken is the whole chicken going to Yardbird, sitting in a Yardbird seat and, you know, having it from tip to tail.
Well, you know, the thing is that we can gather, like, you don't really get access to 80 chickens a day. You know, like, people don't have, you know, it takes all of those chickens to make 6 thyroid skewers or 8 thyroid skewers, you know? So I think that's what it is like, is more being able to enjoy those things because you're never going to get them anywhere else, really, except for other yakitori restaurants.
Or in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully I'll see you there soon. Thanks so much for being on The Food Scene.
Thank you.
Listen, you've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. A big thank you to our sponsor, Music by Cookies, and Matt Patterson Engineering. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.